We'll turn again to the first letter of Peter, chapter 2. Peter chapter 2, and we began last week to think about verses 9 to 10. Peter is writing to Christians who are struggling. Before they were Christians, things had been much easier for them. They had grown up in a very close-knit society. They knew where they belonged. Every one of them had his own place in that society. A man who grew up in the society of Asia had a special bond with other people from the same racial group as himself. If he was Galatian or Cappadocian or Bithynian, he had a special bond with other Galatians or Cappadocians or Bithynians. A man had a special bond with other people who went with him to the same local shrine, who worshipped the same god or goddess. He had all sorts of bonds based on the religion of the society. There were religious festivals in which everybody joined, maybe festivals to honour the local god, and everyone in the town would take part, and that bound you together. It gave you a sense of belonging. A man had a bond with other people around him just because they shared the same culture. They had the same customs, the same way of life, the same interests. And a man had a bond with others around him because they were part of the same nation, because they shared a common heritage, a common history, because they had the same national pride. A man or a woman in that society was part of a whole network of relationships. And everybody knew where they fitted in. It made them feel secure to know that they had a million people around them with the same racial background, the same religious outlook, the same cultural norms, the same national heritage. Life may not have been easy for many of those people, but at least everyone knew where they belonged. Everybody felt that they fitted in somewhere. But then, these people to whom Peter is writing had become Christians. And all of that changed. They no longer fitted. They no longer belonged in that society. They were no longer accepted by the people of their own racial group. In fact, many of them were rejected even by their own families. They could no longer join in the religious life of the town. When everybody else was at the festival, they could never take part. Remember, in every home there was a little household shrine. And at times the whole family would gather to pay respect to the household gods at the shrine. And if one person in that family became a Christian, then he or she could never be part of the family in that. They could no longer fit in with the culture of that society. All their behavior patterns had changed. They weren't interested in the same things that other people were interested in. They didn't bring up their children the same way as other people did. Their view of marriage was different. Even the way they dressed, the way the women did their hair, was different. And they could no longer feel part of the national life. They could no longer feel proud in the same way of the heritage of the past, a heritage which was built on bizarre legends and myths. these Christians felt that they had lost their roots. They were lonely and they were confused in a world where they no longer fitted. And Peter is writing then to comfort and encourage them. And we began to see last week how he does so. But you are, he begins here in verse 9. He reminds them of who and what they really are. These Christians no longer feel part of the comfortable, reassuring society around them. But they are part of something much bigger, something much grander. They are, this is Peter's first phrase, part of a chosen people, a chosen race, a chosen generation is the phrase you have in the AV. They may no longer feel at ease with their own racial group, but they belong to a new race, a giant family made up of all those who have been born again and received the divine nature. The skin colour and the features you'll find in this new race could vary so much. But there is still a racial resemblance among them all because they all share the likeness of Christ. You are part of that new race, part of that chosen race, says Peter. And then they're part, secondly, of a royal priesthood. Yes, they're no longer part of the comfortable, familiar religion that binds everyone else together. But they are part of a new priesthood. All believers are priests. They all have the right and the duty to come into God's presence, to meet him, to worship him, to serve him. What are the empty trappings of festivals and ceremonies compared with the awesome privilege of meeting God in the Holy of Holies? And thirdly, they're part of a holy nation. And the word here means a culture, a society, a people with common outlook and customs. They belong to a worldwide society of men and women who govern their lives by this book, whose customs, whose way of life is governed by this book. The people around them may think they're strange, but they are the truly normal people. Because they live their lives, they conduct their affairs, they bring up their families by the norm of God's word. And then fourthly, Peter says, they're a people. They're a people belonging to God. They are part of the people, the nation of God. That great community that God has been building all down through the centuries. They have a history that goes back and back, not to some strange legendary hero, but to Solomon and to David and to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Indeed, the history of God's people, God's nation, goes back much further. It goes back before time. It goes back into eternity when God registered the names of all his people in his book of life. You know, in some societies, it happened in ancient Israel, the names of all the members of the nation are written in a register. And you look back through the register and you see your parents and your grandparents right back through the centuries of history and you know where your roots are. Well, the register of God's nation was written before God made the world. You are part, says Peter, of the great people of God, the nation that dominates all history, the nation that will still be there when all other nations have been forgotten. It's a huge and a magnificent vision that Peter gives to us in these four words. You know, we sometimes think of the church as something so insignificant, so fragile. We accept the world's evaluation of us as something to be despised. We were reminded last night again of how pathetic the church may seem. Four believers meeting in a city like Carcassonne, ignored by the world, at odds with the whole society. But what is the church? It's the greatest movement in history. It is the real human race. It's only believers who are truly part of the human race. All others are going to be cut off from the human race. It's a priesthood set apart from other people for the greatest privilege in the world, the privilege of looking into the face of God. It's a whole new society with a whole new way of life. In the church, the life of heaven, the heavenly way of life, is being lived out here on earth. It's the great nation that dominates history. When finally the history of earth is written, the central thread of the whole story will be God's people, God's nation. What God is doing among those four people in Carcassonne is infinitely more important than all the battles, all the revolutions, all the risings and falls of empires down through the centuries. Do you remember in the Old Testament the picture we're given of world history? Daniel, the prophet, pictures human greatness. He pictures human empires, like the statue, he says, of a great man. And one empire is like the head of the statue, and another is its shoulders, and another is its torso, and another the legs and feet. And one on top of another, these empires stand, a huge monument to human greatness. And they look so impressive. But then Daniel says, I saw a stone. A stone cut out without human hands. A stone that God had prepared. And that stone begins to roll. Faster and faster it rolls. And it strikes the statue. And the statue is shattered into smithereens. And the stone grows to fill the whole earth. That is the history of the people of God. All human societies, all human empires, all human cultures, all the institutions that people are so proud of are going to be smashed to smithereens. There'll be nothing left of them. But the work of God, the kingdom of God, the church of God, the people of God, goes on to dominate history, to fill the whole earth. There then you have Peter's four words. They bring home to us the greatness, the magnificence of being a believer, of belonging to God's people. Tell us that if we are God's people, we belong to the most glorious, the most magnificent, the only enduring movement in all history. They assure us that if we don't fit in with this world, it's because we belong to something much more wonderful. But there is something else that is emphasized here. Here we have these four nouns: people, priesthood, nation. But we also, alongside them, have four adjectives. You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God. And those four descriptions make the message of this verse far more wonderful. Each of these four terms, in different ways, makes the same point. And the one point that is being made here is this. The thing that makes God's people so wonderful is this. The fact that they are God's people. They are a generation chosen by God. They are a priesthood serving God. They are a nation holy, set apart for God. They are a people belonging to God. That is the glory of God's people. The fact that they are God's people. These Christians to whom Peter is writing feel themselves rejected. They feel themselves cut off from society. They feel themselves isolated and estranged. But Peter says to them, you belong to God. And if we can take in the wonder, the majesty of that, then so many of our hang-ups, so many of our insecurities would just fade away. You're in the staff room, and everybody else thinks you're strange because you won't go out boozing with the lads, and you don't think jokes about adultery are funny, and you're not interested in the latest vile happenings on Coronation Street, and you won't come in and work double time on the Lord's Day. At times you feel so alone in that place. But then you remember, and a thrill of delight begins to tremble in your heart. I belong to God. The great, the awesome, the limitless God who has all creation for his plaything has chosen me, to be his delight and his friend. He's with me now. I'm his. I'm one of his special people. You're with your family, and you don't fit in any longer. You're always under pressure to do things that you can't do any longer. And your arm is always being twisted in your own family. There's that emotional blackmail that's being exercised all the time. Well, I do think if you really cared about the family, you'd be at your brother's party. All this nonsense about keeping Sunday special. Some of you have known exactly what it is to have your arm twisted in that way. And you feel so small, and you feel so unloved. And you think, if they cared about me, they wouldn't pressure me all the time. And you just feel that you've lost your own family. And then you stop. And you say, ah, but I've a father. I've an eternal father. I've an unchanging father. I've a father who is full of compassion and who cares. I belong to God. And a strange peace begins to take hold of you. The psalmist says, when my father and mother forsake me, the Lord will receive me. The reason why we do not fit in this world is because the Lord has separated us off for himself, because he has received us. So let's just look for a moment then at these four words. The four words which stress the fact that we are God's. Firstly, he says, you are a chosen people, a chosen generation, God's chosen race. You remember that in the verse before, verse 8, Peter has told us about the people of this world who stumble and fall because they disobey the message, which is also what they were destined for. All these fashionable people who seem so sure of themselves, who fit in so easily in this world. Peter says God has destined them to fall. God has destined them to be ruined, to spend eternity in shame and horror and wretchedness. God has left them to their own way. And it may seem to them a very attractive way, but it's the way to destruction and everlasting shame. But God has chosen you, says Peter. You are a chosen people. There's the world. All right. It's a world of madmen. It's a world of people running towards destruction. And you were in that world. But God has chosen you out. God chose you for himself. Every individual Christian was chosen by God before the world was made. We looked at that in the opening verses of our letter. And because every Christian was chosen by God, therefore every Christian is God's treasured, precious possession. That's why we choose anything. A couple are visiting an orphanage in Romania. And as they go round, they see so many children. But there's one child in particular. Maybe he's the most wretched looking, the most filthy and malnourished of them all. And they say, this is the one we're choosing. She's going to belong to us. We're going to love her. We're going to treasure her. She's going to be special to us forever. God has done that. Every believer can say, God has chosen me. God has adopted me into his family, into the chosen race. I'm special because I'm precious to him. The world may not want me. My family may not want me. But God wants me. God has chosen me. Every Christian is individually, personally chosen by God. But more than that, the church as a whole, God's people as a whole, is chosen by God. You know, people can be so proud of their racial descent. The Nazis believed that they belonged to the master race. The Welsh knew they were wrong. There is only one chosen race. When God looks down on this earth, and when God asks, where is the nation that has my special love? Where is the race that I treasure and that I keep as my own? What does he see? It's not Britain. It's not Germany. It's not the USA. It's not Israel. It's not even Wales. But there is a people. There is a race whom he loves. It's the race of those who have been joined to Jesus Christ. It's the race of those who share his status and his likeness as God's son. That's the race that is beautiful in God's eyes. That's the chosen race. Every true Christian has been individually chosen to belong to the chosen people. And then the second word. Peter says you are a royal priesthood. Commentators disagree about exactly what Peter means by this word here and what a royal priesthood actually is. But one thing is clear. Peter is telling us that we are associated with the king. He may be saying that we personally are royal because we belong to the King's family. We are ourselves kings with Christ. Or he may be saying that we are a priesthood that has a royal function, a priesthood that serves the King, that lives in the King's palace. But either way, Peter is saying, you have royal connections. You have a position of huge dignity because you are associated with the King, with the Majesty on high, with the Lord, the ruler of heaven and earth. You are constantly going in and out of His presence, His throne room. You have the ear of the King. You are beloved to the King. To be a member of God's true people is to have a status. It is to have a huge dignity. You know, often God's true people are made to feel small by the contempt, the patronizing tone with which religious people treat them. Oh, you belong to that little group that meets in the ambulance hall, isn't it? And there's this implication that there's something wrong with you. You must be ignorant. You must be weird. One of my theology lecturers at college used to talk about bush Baptists. Evangelical Baptists are people who live out in the bush. They've not come into the 20th century. They're some sort of strange aborigines. You know, so often in these days of grand ecumenical schemes, the bishop or the chairman of the local ecumenical committee will speak on behalf of all the churches. And the implication is that gospel churches who aren't involved aren't churches at all. They're just some strange cult. They're just some weird sect out there on the fringes. And we begin to feel that we've got something to be ashamed of. As I say, four people in Carcassonne, the dwindling handful of gospel believers in Portugal, made to feel like dirt by the religious establishment, and ourselves, the neo-Puritan fringe. And Peter says, you're a priesthood, and you're royal. Hold your heads up high. If you're one of God's true people, never be ashamed of it. They may have the cathedral buildings and the stained glass and the fantastic choirs, but you have a place in the household of the King. You are priests who have been chosen for the service of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. You have a dignity that they cannot begin to imagine. You know God. And then the third word. Peter says, you are a holy nation. And we've met this word often in 1 Peter. To be holy means to be set apart for God alone, for His use, for His service. In Old Testament times, in the temple, certain pots and pans were holy. That's to say, they were to be used only for one purpose. They were to be used in the worship of God. Now, let's backtrack a moment. Peter has described believers here as a nation, a community of people bound together by a common culture, a way of life. And it's a way of life that runs right against the current of the world. The world says pleasure is what matters most. Christians say duty. Christians say live for eternity. The Christian way of life is utterly different from the world's way of life. The Christian parent disciplines and controls his children when the world says, oh, let them express themselves. The Christian wife submits to her husband when the world says, you must be free. You must fulfill your own personality. The Christian man at work gets on with his work, however boring, cheerfully and thankfully, because he's doing it for God. The Christian disciplines himself in every area of life, in the way he keeps his home, in the way he spends his money, in the time he gets up and the time he goes to bed, in the books he reads, in the food he eats. The whole pattern of life is different from the world. If the world's fashions tell women to dress for attention, then Christian women dress modestly. If the world tells Christian teenagers that they must admire such and such a rock star, the Christian teenager refuses to give his admiration to anyone who lives an immoral life. The Christian is different. He belongs to a different nation, a different culture. And at times that is hard. At times we wish we didn't have to have this constant self-discipline. At times we wish we didn't have to be constantly guarding ourselves against the world's thinking. At times we wish we could just relax and go along with the tide, because it would be so much easier. We wish we could fit in with the society around us. Peter says here, remember, the reason you are different from the world is that you are holy. You have been set aside for God. The Christian community must be different from the world because it's been set apart for the holy God. All this self-discipline, all this guarding of yourself, all this refusal to conform, all this determination to steer clear of everything that's dubious, it's not pointless. It's not arbitrary. It's not simply that somebody's made up a set of impossible rules to ruin your life. The reason for it all is so that you'll be fit to be near God. It's so that you'll be able to live close to God without grieving Him. You are to be holy because He is holy. The reason you are going to take on a Christian lifestyle, even if it makes you seem bizarre and weird in the eyes of the world, is because you want to climb the holy hill. And you want to enter the sanctuary where you will see the face of God. You want to know God. You want to look through all the years of your life and then on into eternity, into the majesty and the beauty of the living God. And therefore you must be holy. All these petty little matters, these matters of ordering your lifestyle, these matters of setting the alarm clock, these matters of keeping your home neat and tidy, they're not trivial, because they are all part of holiness. They are all part of becoming like God and becoming fit to be with God. They are all part of seeking God Himself. It is because you are God's that you will take on this holy lifestyle. You are a holy nation. And then finally, my time is gone. All of these things are summed up for us in the last phrase. You are a people belonging to God. It's one word in the original. In the Authorized Version, it's translated, you are a peculiar people. And that simply sums it all up. When in Old English they talked about something being peculiar, they didn't mean it was weird. They meant it belonged to somebody in particular. And he says, you are a people who belong to God. You are his own special, unique, darling people. You are the people he has bought. You are the people whom he has made his own. You are the people who are God's and will be God's for all eternity. What has the world to offer us compared with this? What has the world to offer us compared with being God's chosen? With being royal? With being holy, set aside for God? What has the world to offer us compared with belonging to God as his own special, unique, treasured people? The world can laugh, and the world can sneer, and the world can say you're strange, and the world can cut you off. And if they do, it will hurt. If your own family cut you off, it will hurt. But Peter says, what God has brought you into is something infinitely more precious than anything you can lose. Saviour, if of Zion City I by grace a member am, let the world despise or pity, I will glory in thy name. Fading is the worldling's pleasure, all his boasted pomp and show. Lasting joys, lasting treasures, none but Zion's children know. May God apply these things to our hearts.